brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. There's been some massive narrative games played by the Bedroom Battlefields community down in England these past couple of years, and they've been driven predominantly by Jason, who, as it turns out, has been chatting away with none other than Rick Priestley. Well, Jason asked Rick if he'd like to continue the conversation in front of the mic, and I'm delighted to say that Rick accepted. So this episode is part one of a massively enjoyable chat about narrative wargaming between Jason, Rick and Mark. I ran the recording session, but I didn't actually take part, choosing instead to sit and paint Blood Bowl miniatures whilst listening along. It was probably the most brilliantly surreal hobby moment that I've ever had. Anyway, enough preamble and we'll get straight into it. Here's Jason.
Me and Mark have just been talking about the big game that we're putting on in January, which we've been trying to do these games in the style of gaming that you wrote about in the 80s and 90s, which seems to have disappeared in my circuits. I just wondered whether you've had that sense as well, because you agreed to sort of have some recollections of the way you guys... Do you still game this way now in the way that you did back then in your own circuits?
Probably less so. I mean, most of the games, tabletop war games I play these days tend to be big multiplayer affairs. So in that sense, they're multiplayer affairs. They're similar, and we don't, typically we don't play, we never play with points values or anything like that. And we always do come up with something that's a basic scenario, but it won't be very complex. It'll be something like, these objectives on the table are worth so many points. There are 2 points for that, 1 point for this, 2 points for that, and we'll play until a certain time and then toss up the objectives. So that's a lot simpler than the sort of narrative or a scenario-based, almost role-playing games that we used to play. Were I playing something smaller scale, like my Warlords of Erewhon game, for example, I would come up with a scenario, and I would probably play that. And the last one I did play exactly as I would have played in the late 70s and early 80s. So, yes and no. It depends on the game.
Okay, so the games that we've been playing have been massive games, because that's my thing at the moment. I really like playing with lots of toy soldiers on the table and then just having some really silly stuff going on, but still having a game that can be won in the background. And I've been trying to get my head around it, because it doesn't seem natural.
Doesn't it? What you're describing sounds entirely normal to me. I mean, I've seen some of the photographs as well. So I see you're playing quite big games, aren't you? Well, quite big in terms of you've got a fairly big table.
Yeah.
I mean, when we play big Napoleonic games around at the Perry's, I mean, we're playing on a 12 or 14 feet wide, six feet wide, 14 feet long. Sort of table, and the Perrys like to shovel the toy soldiers on. They are really big games, but we're playing with a basic unit. It's quite a big footprint, so really you're not playing with all that many elements. We're in a skirmish type of war game where every figure can be an element. You know, a big game can be 100 figures very easily.
Okay.
So I don't know how many figures you're playing with typically.
2,000.
2,000, my God!
it varies. It depends how many people bring along. But my collection is around 1,200, 1,500 of painted stuff. But it's mostly goblins, of course.
Good. A lot of green paint being used over the years, I imagine.
Luckily, it's the Lord of the Rings ones. So it's not many green.
Yeah.
So I rather like them.
They're nice. They're nice figures, and they're is this the Games Workshop Lord of the Rings ones? The ones we brought out about 2000 in the first, 2000, 2005, that sort of period, wasn't it?
It's entirely your fault. Yes.
Sorry about that. Yeah, those are nice figures because we went back to a slightly smaller size, and I think that improved things a lot.
I do like the smaller size for the games. They look better ranked up as well, having a bit more of a because you only did a limited range, that when you rank them up, they look like they're in formations of some kind, unless they're dancing, in which case I tried to cut limbs.
Yeah.
Which you should do with dancers, I think, just to get them back in place.
Yeah, the disco dancing orcs was a terrible thing. Games Workshop tended to do, and you could never get the things on bases.
I love it that way. But I'm very interested, because you've evolved in the way that you advocate gaming over time then. Is that based on the sizes of your collections, just to keep it simpler? Because in the third edition book, you're very much saying about having all these narrative elements within scenarios.
And we did in the first and second editions. I mean, when we produced the first Warhammer, I mean, the whole background, the whole gaming background, and you have to remember that in the early 80s, gaming wasn't the universal or cool thing it is now. It was quite an unusual thing. But D&D had happened, and consequently, yeah, he couldn't really sell a war game on the back of a traditional wargaming format, but you could sell any amount of role-playing games. So the first Warhammers were pseudo role-playing games with a kind of rank them up and fight them as armies element to it. And that naturally tends to give you a scenario-based game or an adventure-based game or situational-based game, whatever you want to call it. You know, where you're reenacting a little story.
Well, those are the games that I'm enjoying most. And I've never really played them before. It's always been quite... Because I'm 37 and I got into the gaming properly at around 2000 is when I started understanding it. Because it was just, oh, this is cool. I'll have these, please, Mum, before that. And you didn't have a clue what I was doing. But from then on, I was just playing those standard scenarios from the books or in a more competitive environment. And I don't like that, I found out. It's just the only gaming that was around me.
It is weird, isn't it? It's very strange. Gaming seems to have become much more competitive and rules and systems and models and everything has become oriented towards a much more competitive environment. There was always that aspect to wargaming, but the origins of toy soldier wargaming are rooted in that sort of narrative wargame to some extent. It's not rooted in points. If you look at the original fathers of the wargame in Britain, at least, people like Donald Featherstone and Charles Grant, Brigadier Peter Young. And if you go back and read their books, they don't have points values. The idea of your armies being equally matched is entirely a judgment. And the troops you bring to the game are entirely within the... it's up to the players. And the assumption is that the players are going to get together and create a story or create a situation whereby they can play this game. And play is perhaps the operative word, because it's almost like you're reenacting something that's a little bit of theatre as much as anything else, rather than a competition.
Well, it's you that's put me onto this, because it was only in our first email, we've emailed each other a couple of times because of this. Thank you very much for answering. But I just didn't understand what this style of play was. It was so entrenched in the sort of the modern era of gaming that I just didn't understand. What do you mean, no points? What on earth is that? And like I say, it isn't necessary at all, is it? And the whole thing of being a theatre, very much play, I call it the art of cocking around. And it becomes very fun for everyone involved, and it unfolds in some ways that I don't find is what I expect to happen.
It's much more like the early role-playing. So I think something which is it's fairly well understood these days is that the whole D&D, Gary Gygax role-playing phenomenon, and it was that, it really just became a craze in the late 70s, early 80s, and suddenly... at schools, people who would never have thought of becoming war gamers or consider themselves toy soldier players became role players. But that whole genre stems from exactly the same type of wargaming as conventional wargaming. So in the 60s, Gary Gygax was actually contributing to a magazine called Wargamers Newsletter. And that's a magazine, an old-fashioned type of magazine, more like what we'd have called a fanzine. It was produced on a wet copy, very amateurish, typed. And it was circulated by Donald Featherston, who wrote many books on wargaming. And Gary Gygax contributed to that, as I said. And so did the guys in the Bristol Wargames group, Skirmish Wargames group, I think they called themselves, who produced sort of narrative-based wargame systems, one of which was a Wild West game. I think it might be even called the Old West Skirmish System or something like that. And Gary Gygax, I probably had access to that. And the interesting thing about it is it's a set of gaming rules that allow you to play Western gunfights. So what you're doing is every Western gunfight movie that's in your head, and there were a lot of those in the 70s, you know, think of all the Dollars movies and all the classic Westerns and all that. It was very much in our heads as youngsters because we'd grown up with it. So what you're doing is you're not playing a competitive war game, you're reenacting those films or you're reenacting those circumstances. You can take the Dollars movie, A Few Dollars More, and translate it into a medieval environment if you want, or whatever. So all those narrative ideas were in there, and Gary Gygax picked up on it. He developed a lot of the ideas that were current in terms of progressing characters and the telling a story sort of element, and ran with it. So traditional wargaming and role-playing come from that same place, and it's quite narrative. So I think what you're doing is normal.
Right. Well, for us, it was a bit of a, for me anyway, I shouldn't speak for everyone else, but for me, it was quite a discovery because I haven't been used to it. And it's something that's been just died away within the culture around me. I'm in Berkshire, down in the south, yeah, in between London and Bristol. And it's just not a common scene around here for some reason, either that or I'm not invited, more likely. And as a games master now that I've been running my own games with some pointers from yourself and others and things like this, it's the most fun I've ever had, having that element in there and me playing around with people.
Yeah, it's hanging around. And also being the games master, the guy running the scenario, there's only one rule in these things, and that's the games master is always right. And Lovely. There's a sort of social contract, isn't there, between you and the players. It's like the players accept that you're always right, but you can't show favoritism particularly. You can't cheat. You have to have a certain amount of, I'm running this, but I can be trusted to run it. And it kind of is fun. You can't be too competitive with those kind of games, but that's not the objective. I always say everybody wins. Everyone who wins, because everyone's going to have a good time. And that's how those games are constructed. They're usually done on a sort of a let's see what happens basis rather than on the who wins basis.
Yeah. And yeah, I have to admit, Rick, that the people... Sorry, do you mind me calling you Rick? I haven't actually asked.
No.
So I've said Mr. Priestley and Mr. P. I've got a lot of different types of characters that have been joining in these games. Some of them are slightly more leaning towards, they like the game as a puzzle or something to unlock, more of a competitive lean.
Yeah.
And some of them are very much more the artsy types who like to have that story. None of them are on the extremes of those spectrums because I find it difficult to get on with either camp and the extreme ends. Because it's just my nature, especially with the competitive end. I just simply don't understand it. I don't understand why they don't play chess at that very extreme end. That's my bias. So I still need a game that can be unlocked and won, but have that balance of having not quite random narrative elements, but variables that allow these stories to emerge, but not without breaking a game. And is that something?
Yeah, they're like roots to a solution. And it's a question of working your way through, isn't it? and finding which every route might take you to the solution, but some will give you a more difficult than others, or some are more demanding or demand certain things. And that's typical of a role playing environment. You know, you can't really set a game up where the players have one objective and there's one way to win it, and they either do it or don't do it. That's a little bit boring. It's much more interesting if things are happening on the periphery, and let's say it's a jailbreak scenario, and you fail to actually get the you light the dynamite, and you think, oh, now the jail's going to blow it, and it blows out or it doesn't work. But you have to have some other way of achieving what you want, and that might be the jailer might go, something terrible. We'll move everyone out of the jail because there's something happening, and now you've got the guys on the run, and you can chase them and fight. You've got to do something like that. You've got to create opportunities for people if one thing doesn't work, and sometimes on the fly. And that's where these narrative games have a kind of strong role-playing connection, I think.
Yeah, and a bit of magic to them, because there's something that emerges that you just think, how on earth could that have happened?
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you get hilarious situations happening or completely nonsensical things. You think, well, yeah.
We've had dozens of them, and it's been fantastic. So the GM is actually bringing in a lot of elements and a lot of fun that can't be had from a book alone.
Yeah, the books are just a starting point or a bit of a prop.
Yeah. Is this because you guys and other companies and everything, all these games started bringing out things like campaign packs? So you put me onto one from the old days called Orcs Drift. I bought Arthur Orcs Drift, and that was really fun. Is that a replacement for a GM? Because you could have some of these campaign packs, you're doing that where some players can't have a GM, is a book version of one.
You're kind of trying to do, I think we recognized, particularly because we were selling toy soldiers and we were in, commercially, we were marketing a range in a game and so on and so forth. I mean, Warhammer was created as a marketing tool for toy soldiers, really. And bearing in mind, the so-called industry at the time was tiny, and we were trying to sort of scrape a living together as much as anything else. So Bloodbath at Orcs Drift has that kind of thing where you can play. I think you can play it with a games master. In fact, I think you're encouraged to, if I remember right.
You are, yeah.
It's got an element.
So I've got it in front of me. It says you can do either. Here is how you do it without one, and it's better if you have one.
Yeah, exactly. We were trying to remove barriers, because if there's two guys, two school friends who want to play the game and they haven't got a games master, what do you do? So you kind of like make allowances for that. I seem to remember there's an element in that game, in that particular campaign, where the elf leader and the dwarf leader, one has to pretend to be deaf, and one has to, one's told that the other one will always ignore him, and he should. So they're set against each other. One's yelling at the other one and one ignoring right from the start. And that's kind of like a gag. But you can't do that unless you've got a Games Master.
Well, why did Games Masters start getting dropped away from the literature? Because you shifted over to campaign systems and even narrative campaign packs, and they even dropped away largely at some point. From magazines even as well, not just from Games Workshop. I'm talking just everywhere. It's just sort of stopped being spoken about.
It became what happened was as the hobby grew, the people that came on board were much more literal. I don't know why. I think in the early days, perhaps people who were attracted to this sort of thing were slightly more arty. We wouldn't have called them geeky, but or nerdy. But they were the slightly awkward kids, clever, awkward, bright. Bright, but you're a little bit not sporty, not really sociable in the normal, typical sort of manner. And I think that's what they tended to band together and do. And wargaming was a social activity that allows teenage boys who are not necessarily good at socializing anyway a means of socializing. Because it gives you stuff to talk about and do together, and so on. It's a very it gives you a kind of a club or a little group, and that's how it kind of grew. In wargaming was appealing to those people. It wasn't appealing to the average schoolboy who just wanted to kick a football about. And then as it grew, I think more and more people started to see the attraction. But it was those people who were fundamentally more literal-minded or less creative or whatever, more typical. And they were looking more for something that was a straightforward game. And the model changed slightly from being based on D&D and role-play with a militaristic and a toy soldier element to being more in the style of a traditional ancient wargame. Ancient wargaming in the 70s had become quite formalized. It was the first type of wargame that started to talk in terms of strict points and strict army compositions. I don't know why. The guy that was responsible for it, largely, there's a group of people, but the guy who was largely responsible for it was called Phil Barker. Phil Barker's still alive, actually.
Well, no one shot him.
Yeah. He's still there.
Sorry, betraying my bias there.
But it became quite big, and ancient wargaming has always had that character to it. It's inherited it, and to this day, ancient wargaming is still very competition based. So you'll line up on one side of the table, your opponent will line up on the other side of the table. You'll have 1,000 points worth of something, ancient Egyptians. He'll have 1,000 points worth of Romans. They'll argue endlessly about historical reality, but quite happily fight out of period. And they will just have this straight bash.
That's the majority of my friends.
That to some extent is what Warhammer became. That's a type of wargaming. It's a little bit bland, but it obviously has a strong appeal to a certain mindset.
Yeah. I'd say the majority of my friends are probably more towards that leaning. Many of them can be a bit of a salad. They can have a bit of each, depending on what mode they're in.
Yeah.
But it is the majority of them are playing that way, and I just can't enjoy it as often as were these narratives.
Well, I think what you're doing, which is like building a story and then winding all the characters up and letting them go and see what happened. It's almost like a play, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's actually quite hard work. I mean, the reason why I think we tended to steer away from that, or rather we were pulled away from it by sales and commercial requirement, you know, most people wanted to play a straightforward game. And I think it's because what you're doing is quite difficult. You need a certain kind of innate creativity and prepare to do the hard work, but also have the sort of personality that can facilitate that kind of game. And a lot of people don't. You know, a lot of people don't quite have that. It needs quite a light touch, really. Because you can easily upset people if you're seen to be unfair or whatever, or make it up as you go along, even if you want. Yeah.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show.
I can see that risk. I mean, I was accused of it the other day, and I got out of it by the skin of my teeth, mostly with biscuits. Is that why a lot of these campaign packs came in then? Because you were saying about how much effort it is that you could write it down for people's behalf to get a bit of variation in their game without needing a games master or the background work.
That happened with role playing as well in the early 80s, late 70s even. The original concept of D&D was very much, here's a very skeleton set of rules. But, you know, rules, use them or don't use them, whatever. Very, very free form. If you've ever seen the first edition or second edition of D&D, they're incredibly cheerfully, you know, make it up as you go along. Here's a table, use it or don't use it. And you're entirely left to your own devices when it comes to creating the dungeon environment that they describe. And the first supplements were really just the dungeons or the adventure settings that the authors had created for themselves. But then when they started to get commercial bent, you know, they were trying to sell stuff, they started to bring out these campaign packs that were, if you're the, they'd go something like, if you're the games master, read this out now. You know, it's almost like telling you through how to do it step by step. And it's obvious that they were trying to deal with exactly the same things we were with Warhammer. They were trying to deal with a new customer base that wasn't really quite comfortable with the free-form kind of game that they'd invented. And I think over iterations of D&D, it's become increasingly like that. It's taken away from that creative aspect. And we did the same thing. And I thought it was a great shame. And I started to, I think it would be in the 90s. It would be, when would it be? 95, maybe, that sort of time. I was trying to reintroduce, no, it'd be 96, because that was the fifth edition of Warhammer. I tried to reintroduce the idea of narrative campaigns with things like The Grudge of Drong, Tears of Aisha. I think there were another couple. It was an undead one, wasn't there?
That was five of them, yeah.
Five, yeah, okay. That's good. But the what I found by then was I think the idea has had its day, but the sales guys couldn't sell them. And the reason they couldn't sell them is because they didn't understand them. They just wanted
the sales guys didn't understand.
There, they didn't understand. They couldn't figure it out. They just wanted. The message came back from the stores. Well, we just want a new edition of the army book. You know, we wanted. So as far as I was concerned, once I'd done the Orc and Goblin army book, for example, which I think I did in 1992 or 93. It was one of the first ones we did for the fourth edition of Warhammer. That was kind of it. You know, you'd given it. That was all the basics. That covered pretty much that standard format of wargaming. And what we hadn't done was explore the narrative side of wargaming. So my concept was that in the next edition of Warhammer, the 96 one, fifth edition, we would launch a series of narrative wargames, including the first one was Grudge of Drong. And they would give us the opportunity to do more troop types, more characters, add more background, and they would be more an interesting way of playing a game. But the sales guys really kicked back on it, and in the end, we had to give up.
Did historical games have that kind of format as well for people? Is a campaign system, or is a story, or what ifs, or anything?
Not really. You'd sometimes get it with. You sometimes do get it with older players who are either playing skirmish war games or. So it's often 18th century style games, but that's because they're referencing back to the 1960s games like Charge, which were tended to have a story behind them, even if they're a large scale war game. So you don't see it much. I think there's a modern genre of gaming which is based on very small forces, skirmish war gaming, where you've got. And you're probably going to have a narrative element of some sort. But even then, not always. Sometimes they just line them up and go. I'm not sure. I've never played any. I don't think I've played any of the more modern games in that style. Mostly because most of my friends have got big collections of toy soldiers and they just want to play big war games all the time. Yeah. I've introduced some they're not games master driven, but I've introduced some narrative elements in the game I've just done with John Wombat, which is a spaceship war game called Space Battles. I tell it like it is, I say. and that's got a series of scenarios in it, as you'd expect any war game to have. But I've tried to give them a story behind each one. But they're still, you know, two-player war games, so they don't have that interaction with the players and any random elements are, you know, determined by either player at the draw of a card or something. So, you know, I don't know, really. It's interesting. I think what you're doing is, I wouldn't say it's unique, but it's interesting to see that idea done to that extent, because it's quite an old-fashioned concept. And as I say, I think the main reason why it's fallen out of fashion is because it's so much effort.
It's interesting you say that. Oh, it's interesting you say that, because it doesn't feel an enormous amount of effort. I don't know whether just different mindsets are better at different things, because for me, it's an enormous amount of effort to get into a competitive mindset and try and break that thing down. I can't do it.
No, most people, really, they turn up with typical war game. I've got an army. I've got 1,000 points worth of, let's say, Space Marines of some sort. I turn up at the War Games Club. Oh, you've got 1,000 points worth of Veldor. Oh, that's great. Well, we've got 2 hours to have a war game, so you line up, I line up, and they go, and that's it. There's not, you know, there won't be. It's got to work in that context, which means it's, you know, a hookup game. Whereas what you're doing, somebody needs to think about, work it through, consider various nodal points where the game might go this way or that way, and make sure you've covered them. You're probably inventing names of characters, you're inventing names of situations, you're probably providing some, if not all, of the models, or you're aware of which models you've got to take account of. Yeah, it's a lot more work. It's an interesting thing. I think it's definitely a build it and they will come.
Happened for me.
Yeah, that's exactly what tends to happen with these games. You're reliant on one person, a personality, who's the host, who is providing the game and possibly having to provide the beer as well. Tea and biscuits, well, maybe.
Well, for those who have earned their stay, absolutely. But I'm fascinated why it's dropped away at all, because it's so much fun. And there's got to be more people than just me, because of the guys that are on our Discord, on Matthew's on Matthew's podcast.
Yeah,
are all similar-minded. They always create these things just out of the ether. For instance, just yesterday, I went to play a different game with a friend of mine, and we were just chatting about some nonsense about cheese. And I know it sounds obscure, but it ended up being, oh, what if halflings made this cheese that could put a troll on its arse? Okay, well, now we can raid the halfling's baggage train. That's their battle standard bearer. If it gets stolen, there's a 1 in 6 chance that they're going to pass out. But they're also going to a frenzy if they take it. And now we've got a game out of nowhere in seconds.
Yeah, because there's a story behind it. And the story and the situation and the characters, they give you a game, but they also almost inevitably all inform what would happen in other circumstances. You know, the eagles passing overhead see this going on, thinking, oh, there's some cheese there, you know, and so on and so forth. You can, wait a minute, there's Skaven, there's cheese noshing Skaven are the troublemakers, aren't they? You know,
that's exactly it.
The story tells itself to an extent. I don't know. It is funny. Have you tried writing up any of these as in the format of, let's say, Grudge of Drom or something like that?
I'm too illiterate, Rick. I'm a builder that's avoided school my entire life. I try to do these things. Thank God for Mark and for Ed and for other people around me who have been to school. Right. And they actually write these things. So Mark, for instance, my partner in crime here, he's been helping me run these things, and he's done all of the pushing on the internet, talking to people, because he's just, well, Mark, perhaps you can speak for yourself on this point and ask something.
Yeah, sure. I think what's been really significant with doing this is what we've created has been, like Jason said earlier, it's felt like more than the sum of its parts. And I think speaking to that idea of it being a lot of work, I think you're right, Rick. It can seem like a lot of work, but a lot of it has naturally emerged because I think we've got the right group of people together. And that all sort of started life, really, because we met one another through Matthew's community. So we already had a common denominator. We already had something that, you know, what is it that brings us to the table? And it wasn't to win. It was to tell a story.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot of players who play you know, for example, we'll have people who say, well, I've got a Skaven army or some Skaven, and I'm therefore going to do Skaveny things in my decision making. I won't try and win the game. I'll try and behave in a manner that's fitting to that story. And that's been really significant because it's allowed the story to kind of assemble itself, really, through, I suppose, what is in essence role playing.
It is. I think what you're doing is kind of it's very, very similar to the skirmish wargaming ethos that evolved into role playing. And the only real difference was that role playing did away with the toy soldiers because they suddenly found they were more interested in the personal interactions of the characters. And when you've got one person represents one model, you suddenly don't need the table or the scenery or whatever. Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? You see, I'd very much like to see you guys write up something and have it in one of the glossy Wargames mags.
We've written some stuff up in terms of kind of after action reports, and I mean the other thing that Jason hasn't really alluded to is not only are these games in of their own right kind of big story events, but actually he's running it in a kind of quite grand campaign style as well, in between games, with, you know, little mini games that happen and two opposing teams, the goodies and the baddies, and we can decide amongst ourselves in little chats that are not privy to the other people, you know, what stuff we want to do, and we want to go off scouting or some random events have happened. But, so there's a lot of stuff going on.
That's exactly how the Gygax and his mates made the transition, because they were playing medieval style war games.
Is that the chainmail?
Yeah, chainmail was their core set of rules. And chainmail was probably the rules they adapted then into the first versions of D&D.
Mm. It's very similar to the Tony Bath campaigns, isn't it?
Yeah, the Hyborian campaign. I'm not sure to what extent they did side adventures.
It's right.
Let's do a side adventure where our assassins go into a castle and murder somebody. And so you've now got something essentially a little D&D adventure.
Yeah, Jason, you ran something the other day, didn't you, which was to do with, we've got this siege battle coming up in January, and there's underneath the castle, the Dwarven Hold, there's some mines. So Jason used a Dungeon Saga, the Mantic game, as the engine to run a underground thing to see what the determination of that was.
Yep. I mean, that's all. You're exactly in the same place as people like that guy Gats were in the late 70s.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, it sounds like we're in good company. One thing that I think has been really significant is we've had quite a few people sort of from the outside in looking at, sort of being quite interested and being a little confused because some of the terminology, you know, we might put a banner up that says we're having a Warhammer Day.
Yeah.
And to a lot of people now, that's shorthand for a very different thing to how I would perceive Warhammer, having got into it in the third edition.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because we're almost shooting ourselves in the foot by using that word, because people take that as shorthand for some kind of the pickup games that you referred to earlier.
Yeah, the Warhammer has become shorthand for 40K.
Yes. Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah. It's just confusing too.
Which is quite weird, isn't it? Yeah. No. I and really, by the third edition of Warhammer, which is the one you started with, we'd started to move very strongly in the direction of a traditional war game.
Mm.
And I think we produced Omnilists straight away. You see, the advantage of that competition style game and points values from a commercial point of view is it encourages people to collect armies.
Yes.
And that's what we were trying to build at the time.
And presumably change their mind about things. Oh, those aren't very good. I'm going to go and buy, that bolt thrower wasn't good. I'm going to buy a catapult.
I've been beaten by a dragon this week. I'll go and buy a dragon.
Mm.
You know, it was like that. So there's a certain amount of competition within the army list or within the army collections. Yeah, it is odd. No, I think what we're doing sounds really interesting. It's I know that it would be really interesting to read as a kind of an article. What would you call it?
evangelical.
Yeah, a bit of evangelism.
That's absolutely the angle that we come at it from. Absolutely. Which is interesting you've used that term, because Jason and I, we've spoken about that, haven't we, about sort of trying to spread the good word about how, you know, war games don't need to be these miserable things which make you feel bad. They're actually genuinely quite fun.
Yeah. I didn't know they made you feel bad.
I think it's the 40k players these days that seem to kind of be a little bit upset about things. And it seems a shame because, you know, it feels like things have become very, very serious.
It's the way the Games Workshop have taken the game more recently, I believe. You have to remember, I left in 2010, so I've not actually had anything to do with Games Workshop for a long time.
Absolutely.
15 years. And I've not played any Games Workshop games at all. But I've still got some friends who do occasionally or routinely play either mostly 40K. And a friend of mine recently, he actually took part in a 40K competition. And he pretty much said never again. It was so joyless.
Huge thanks to Jason, Mark and of course Rick for that brilliant conversation. And you'll be able to hear part two on the next episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your own thoughts and opinions about this style of gaming over in the Bedroom Battlefields Discord. It's free to join and full of kind and positive hobbyists. You could find it at bedroombattlefields.com/discord. That's bedroombattlefields.com/discord. All right, cheers for listening, and we'll chat again on the next one.